This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Liv and Lynn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. After 20 years of war, the Taliban have taken control of Afghanistan. The 20-year conflict has killed tens of thousands of people and displaced millions more. And how the Taliban plan to govern Afghanistan remains unclear, but women are especially fearful, considering that when they last held power, the Taliban strictly enforced their ultra-conservative interpretation of Sunni Islam that included banning women from going to school or working. So Dr. Johanna Higgs, who's a women's rights activist, she's an anthropologist and the founder of the women's rights advocacy group Project Monma, spent some time in Afghanistan to learn more about the situation of women's rights in the country. And she's joining me now to share her experiences of living there and also what she learned about the way of life and rights of women in Afghanistan. Welcome, Johanna. How are you today?
Hi, I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
So, Johanna, my goodness, we last spoke, it was October 2017, almost 4 years ago. And of course, you were telling me about Project Monma then. And I remember that you were actually in Tajikistan.
Tajikistan.
That's right. Which is near the border of Afghanistan, right? And you were about to head there.
Yeah, that's right. I was in the small town of Khark. And which is right on the border, which is in Tajikistan, but right on the border where there's a border crossing with Afghanistan. Yeah. And I was just about to cross into Afghanistan at that time.
Yeah. Okay. So, but before we talk about that, I just think maybe you can just refresh our listeners' memories about Project Monma. You know, that's what we were talking about all those years ago. Can you just remind us what it is you do through that project?
Sure. Yeah. So Project Monma aims to raise awareness about violence and discrimination against women and girls around the world. And the main way of doing this is through sort of mini research projects that I've done in many parts of the world, in Afghanistan, in various parts of Africa, in various parts of Asia, in the Middle East, South America. And basically the idea is to draw on stories and to find, you know, to speak to women, girls and men about the situation of violence against women or discrimination in their societies, and just to hear what they have to say about it. And also to generate awareness about what is happening around the world when it comes to violence and discrimination against women and girls, because I think that it's a topic that's not so spoken about in most places in the world. It's something where it's deemed cultural, whether it's to suppress women's rights or, you know, whatever it is. And so I think that it's really important to generate discussion on these topics in order to help improve the situations for women and girls and in different parts of the world.
Yes. And I remember asking you this even back then, you know, because you were traveling all over the world, you know, this Caucasian woman, you know, going to all these different remote places. And I remember asking you how locals, you know, took to having to your presence there, actually, you know, living within their communities and you know, asking them all these difficult questions and challenging their way of life.
Yeah. So that can be a varied experience. I've found that there is often very negative perceptions of Western women that don't play into my favor. Or I think also the fact that I'm often alone is also a problem in many cases, because in so many parts of the world, women just aren't allowed to be alone. So, you know, whether according to whatever social and cultural norms. So the fact that I'm there by myself often, I think, makes me a little bit of a target. Mm. And it can be very challenging at times, and that's putting it nicely. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go back to where we left off, you know, all those years ago. So you were just about to head into Afghanistan at that point in time. Am I correct? Tell me what happened. Yeah. What happened after?
Yeah. So I went and got an Afghan visa, which was surprisingly easy. There was a little Afghan consulate in that town. Mm-hmm. And I hired a driver to take me to the border, which was, I would say, have to say, one of the most remote border crossings I've ever been to, largely because there was nobody there. There was just a Tajik border guard who seemed very, very, very surprised that I was there and that I was going into Afghanistan. And he escorted me up to the border where I was met by the Afghan border guard. And it was kind of like this big prison fence thing marking the border. It was a very strange experience, and going through it and then going into Afghanistan, it was just like a completely different world. Tajikistan is a Muslim country, and they are obviously living side by side with the Afghans, and the only thing marking the difference between this border was this little river. But it was just incredible, the differences. And just not only the way in that the people were dressed, both the men and the women, but just in the attitudes that I came across. So in Horog and on the Tajik side, there were women walking around in jeans and they didn't have their hair covered and they were going to university. And I mean, there were some women who also had their hair covered. It was more free, right? So there was choice. But on the Afghan side in Ishkishim, this small village, it was all the women were covered in the blue burqas that we're seeing on the television at the moment, you know, with what the Taliban require women to wear. It was mostly men on the street. They were all wearing traditional Afghan dress. And it was very intimidating to go there as a single woman. I think mostly because, I think there were a lot of reasons, but I don't think too many women do go there by themselves. And it was very, very difficult.
And I'm sure, I was reading some articles, you know, that you wrote about your time then. You yourself were wondering if you had made, you know, the right decision going there alone at that time, didn't you?
Yeah, because in Ishkishim, I was taken to a guest house. Before I'd gone, I'd made contacts with some teachers from an English school there, and they actually came and picked me up from the border. So that was okay. And they took me and they dropped me at the guest house. But the next day when I wanted to go out and have a look around the village and then look for I wanted to get a SIM card for my phone so I could have a form of communication. And it was just the worst experience. I was followed. I had men driving by in cars, shouting things out at me. I had men coming up to me with no uniform who were claiming that they were policemen. At one point, they were making a circle around me, and they was insisting on me giving them my passport. And these were even men that weren't policemen, or weren't even trying to claim that they were doing this. And it was just unbelievable to me the way that these men felt entitled to show such dominance over me as a stranger, like someone who's not known to them in the street. They thought they could be that dominating over me in that way. And it very much had the feeling that I had committed some kind of crime by being a woman alone on the street. And so I realized I had to get back. And I was terrified. It was the middle of the day. And I had to go down this. After they'd formed this circle around me, I sort of pushed my way out of it. And I just hoped that they wouldn't follow me, which they didn't. But then I need to go down this hill to go up another one to get back to the guest house. And there were more men there. They started to follow me down the hill. So I stopped and I let them go past. They stopped, turned around to come back up, stopped at the top of the hill again to watch me. And it was just this whole, it was absolutely terrifying. So yeah, when I got back to the guest house, I was eventually, I thought, what am I going to do? Because I clearly cannot walk around the town by myself, let alone do any kind of research. And I've got there's no internet in the village. I've got no phone because I obviously couldn't get a SIM card. Mm-hmm. They don't speak English in my guest house. Like, how am I going to get out of here? So, yeah, at that point I was thinking, oh, my goodness, why am I here?
No.
You know, because, yeah.
But tell me then, you know, how did you move on from there? You know, what happened? Did you manage to get somebody's help to, you know, navigate that area?
So what I did was, I'd heard of this, when I was doing my research before I went in, I'd made contact with this school, but I had no way of reaching them from the guest house because I didn't have a phone. But I'd heard there was an organization called the Aga Khan Foundation, and I knew that they had an office in Ishkishim. So I tried to find a way. I was trying to communicate with the owner of the guest house to sort of say to him that I wanted to get to this Aga Khan Foundation because I thought perhaps there I might find someone that could speak English and I might find some internet. And we had this whole exchange between us where he was trying to say, you can go, like, it's no problem. And I was saying, no, there's a problem. And he was saying, ah, no problem. And I would go, problem. You know, so this went on for a bit. Anyways, he knew someone who spoke English, and he called that person, and that person came. And then I told that person what happened, and then he came with another policeman who also had no uniform, and there was this big discussion, and they ended up escorting me into the town. Okay. And then they ended up, the guest house owner knew, and he actually sent some of the little boys from the village to accompany me.
Yeah.
Go ahead. These little boys, he took their job very seriously to protect me on the way to the Aga Khan Foundation. They were so sweet. And they waited for me too. They sat, these little boys, they were like 9 or 10 years old, or maybe a bit older. And they just sat there and waited and walked me home.
That's so sweet.
Yeah, it was. But from there, I was able to gain some form of communication because they had internet. And I was also able to borrow the phone of the guest house owner in the end. And then I was able to organize a car that took me to the next town. But I was also able to get back in contact with the teachers. And then I did end up doing some interviews and talking to some of the teachers and the students that were at that school as well.
Okay. All right. And we're just going to go for a quick break now. But when we come back, I'm going to ask you about, you know, your experiences in Afghanistan and, you know, what you you conducted interviews, as you said, you know, and I'm just curious to hear, you know, what you learned about the way of life there. I'm speaking today to Dr. Johanna Higgs. She's a women's rights activist. She's an anthropologist, and she's the founder of Project Monma, which advocates for women's rights around the world. Keep it right here on Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line today from Cambodia is Dr. Johanna Higgs. She's a women's rights activist. She's an anthropologist. She's the founder of Project Monma, which is an advocacy group which advocates for women's rights around the world. Johanna spent some time in Afghanistan, you know, doing some interviews and researching what women's rights is like over there. And, you know, as we know, the Taliban have taken over and there's a lot of fear, especially for women who aren't quite sure, you know, what's going to play out. You know, before the break, Johanna, you were telling us about rather scary experience when you first, you know, stepped onto Afghan soil. But, you know, once, you know, you had navigated those sort of scary situations, what happened next?
Well, so after that, I was able to do some interviews with some of the teachers that I had met in the school and also some of the students and ask them about some of this, you know, what it was like to be a woman living in Afghanistan and what were some of the challenges that they felt as women. And I was able to ask them about the burqa and how they felt about wearing it. And it was really interesting to hear what they had to say because it seemed that they didn't, even though they were allowed to go to school and they were allowed to study, mm-hmm. There wasn't a lot of choice that they were able to have in their lives about what they would do. I was also taken to visit a group of women who were like, they had like a sewing group and it had been organized by the Aga Khan Foundation, and someone from the Aga Khan Foundation took me there. And I remember on the way to go there, he said, you know, if the Taliban knew that we were doing this, you know, we'd all be in big trouble. Mm. That, you know, that we as men are helping these women, have an income. And it was quite harrowing listening to the stories of the women, because there was a lot of, you know, they had been married very young, whether 14, 15 years old, through forced marriages, you know, where there was no choice of their own who they got to marry. It was just decision from their parents. And even though the Aga Khan Foundation was helping them, you know, with these income generation projects, it was, I think, very difficult for them to be able to manage and to survive on their own, to survive within the context within which they were living, which was in these very remote villages with the Taliban at that time were just 30 minutes away. Mm. And they said they were tired of the war. They were tired of, they wanted security. They wanted peace. They didn't want fighting, you know, as mothers, they were losing children who had sons that were going off to fight the Taliban. So it was a really difficult situation for them.
Okay. And I know that following that trip, you also said that you felt very frustrated, right? Because there was so much unfairness, right? There was, and you were seeing it all over the world, not just in Afghanistan, you know, this frustration about how girls cannot go to school, girls just aren't afforded the same rights as the boys. Am I correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, and there's just so few places in the world where I think that women and girls do genuinely have, you know, equal rights to men in their societies. I'm so pleased to see that the international media is putting so much focus on the Taliban, and I'm so pleased to the Taliban's treatment of women, I should say. And I'm so pleased to see all these male journalists questioning them about it directly in press conferences and so forth. But it really is, having been in many parts of the Middle East and Africa and South America, it is really, whether it's issues of girls being allowed to go to school or sexual harassment or sexual assault or shaming and blaming women and girls who are subject to these things is really a global problem. And it's something that I'm super pleased that the Taliban are being challenged on, but I think that it's something that we all need to be challenged on around the world as to why we tolerate bad behavior towards women and girls in our societies and why we don't afford them the same opportunities as we do to men.
And as you mentioned, you spoke to classrooms of people, you know, young women, you know, asking them about their dreams, asking them about their hopes. You know, what were some of the things that they told you back then? And how do you feel about, you know, what's been happening since?
Yeah, well, in Ishkashim, the girls were talking about, you know, when I asked them what they wanted for the future, that they were kind of hesitant to say at the beginning. I don't know exactly why that was, but they did say things like, oh, you know, well, I would love to be able to be a doctor, or I would love to be able to travel the world. Or I also went to Shugnan, which is another village not far from Ishkashim. And it was really quite different from Ishkashim because they were Ismaili Muslims there. And so they had a much more liberal interpretation of Islam. So as a result, the women were more free. I wouldn't say completely free, but more free. They weren't compelled to wear the burqa. There were a lot more women walking around in the streets there. But I spoke to some students there as well. And I do remember some of the girls talking about things like, you know, very quietly, you know, talking about how they'd like to be able to do things like have parties and, you know, and do things with boys. And these kind of things that would come naturally to any young person, I think, but are so forbidden there. And I do remember having a lot of conversations about love. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of like love is forbidden. Like one of the girls, she said, what did she say to me? Something like, it's seen as a disaster to fall in love in Afghanistan because all marriages should be arranged and they should be approved by the family. And so even being able to choose who you love is not something that is a right, at least in these areas where I was. And so I think that for the students that I spoke to, and also for the teachers, that was something that they didn't like. You know, they wanted to be able to choose who they love. They wanted to be able to make choices over their clothing. They wanted to have the freedom to be friends with or to interact with whoever they want, you know, not be so restricted. So, yeah.
And did you speak to some of the boys as well? You know, did you interview them and sort of get their thoughts on, you know, how things were and, you know, just basically the situation there? What were their reactions and their thoughts?
I did. You know, I interviewed, I remember always in Shugnan interviewing two of the male teachers because they helped me a lot as well. They helped take me around the village and talk to different people, and they translated for me. And they, when I first interviewed them, I sat down with them and they pulled out these two pictures. And one was a picture, like they'd gone to all this effort to print them out and photo, you know, and it was great. And one was of a woman from Afghanistan in the 70s. And they were wearing blouses and knee-length skirts, and they weren't covering their hair. And then they had another picture of a woman with her nose cut off, and another picture of a woman with it, you know, with the burqa. And they wanted to show me, like, to contrast what Afghanistan had been and how it was now. And they said, you know, before there was so much more freedom here, and now women are expected to dress like this. And they were saying there's a lot of really serious violence against women, including, and that was the point of showing me the woman with her nose cut off, because it's this kind of level of control men are allowed to have over women in Afghanistan. They explained that if she goes past, she does something she's not supposed to do, whatever that may be, a man has the cultural right to do that. I mean, I can't comment specifically on how that's received by the judicial system in various parts of Afghanistan, but these men were at least showing me this picture as a way to illustrate the level of violence that women are facing in Afghanistan. So when I asked them, I said, well, what do you guys think? Which is better? How do you want to see Afghanistan? And they pointed to the picture of the women in the blouses and the knee-length skirts, and they said, this is better. You know, we want it to be more like this, for it to be more free. And I also spoke to some of the young male students as well. You know, and you considering the context of where they're living, it's like, you know, this extremely remote sort of village with huge snow-capped mountains and, you know, so far away from anything that, you know, it's not New York, you know, it's not Paris, it's these very remote places. And so I was super impressed with one young male because everything around him was telling him that as a male he was superior and he was, you know, had rights over females. But I remember him because he was saying, you know, I don't think it's right what happens to women and girls here. They should have more freedom. You know, they shouldn't be forced to wear this type of clothing. You know, it's not right. And I think it was so great to meet him because I think that it's like his kinds of voices from young men such as him that really need to be heard, you know, that are speaking out against these kind of conservative ideas and values. But, you know, one of the things that I did find, not only in Afghanistan, but in that whole region as I was traveling, is people are very, very afraid to voice their opinion on these things. Mm. There's a lot of retribution from elders, from mullahs, from, you know, from parents. And so there may be a lot of people who resist these ideas or resist the ideas of the Taliban or don't like, you know, don't want to live under these kind of values. But you won't hear their voices necessarily because they're afraid.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, you know, even speaking to you, the girls, at least they would whisper it to you, right? Must have been so much of fear.
Well, definitely. But I would tell them I would do these things. You know, I said, well, where I come from is we can do this. I do it.
Right.
You know, I have a boyfriend. I have this. I have that. And so I think that that's why. And definitely because I'm female. You know, they never would have explained these to a male.
I can't imagine them doing that either. And I guess, you know, when news broke that the Taliban had taken over, that must have really been devastating for you to hear as well. You know, did you manage to keep in touch with people that you spoke to? Do you know how they're doing at all? You know, not at all.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. When I was there, the Taliban were in a town called Waduj, which was 30 minutes away, and it was known they were in pockets around. And I know this because I was asking. I wanted to travel further out into Afghanistan, so I talked about it a lot with the Afghans that I met. And the general advice was, you know, maybe not. Even though the Taliban don't have control of the government, they're still around. And, you know, if I remember one man said to me, he goes, you've got a 70% chance of nothing happening to you. And I remember thinking that was probably generous. There was probably a higher chance.
Yeah,
that was still a 1 in 3 chance something might happen, right? So I thought, okay, maybe not. So I was shocked. And I am still in contact with one of the teachers in Shugnan. Mm-hmm. And I did speak to him. And he said the Taliban had been there in his village for 2 months already. And he said that they've taken our freedom. But he said they're not harming anyone and they're still allowing girls to go to school and they're allowing the women to go to work, but they can't be in the same place as the men. But he's adamant they're not hurting anybody.
Okay.
At the moment. So, but that's not to say that that's the case everywhere in Afghanistan.
Okay. All right. And, you know, we've been seeing these really harrowing images, you know, on the news, you know, of people trying to flee. And there's that huge debate from, you know, many Western countries, many countries, you know, Malaysia included, of whether we should accept, you know, Afghan refugees. I think, you know, the point is not everybody wants to leave, but they have to leave, right? That is the situation that they're in because they've been aligned to, let's say, you know, Western companies or, you know, the army or whatever, and they are fearful for their and their families' lives, right? I mean, what are your thoughts on that, you know, how the international community should respond to this crisis?
Well, the Taliban are officially saying there's going to be no retribution. Whether that is true, whether that they are going to halt that, I don't know, because I have heard reports from various news channels and the UN who are stating that there have been summary executions taking place. I think that one thing that's important to think about is, like, the Taliban, I think, also enjoy support. They have said this themselves, but I think that this is also true. So the same one person that I spoke to in Sugnan, he just 2 days ago told me that people are going to join the Taliban.
Oh.
And when I asked him why, he said because they feel proud. So, and I remember talking about this with them at the time and asking why people would go to join the Taliban. And they said there's a lot of different reasons. Sometimes it's because they're running away from a problem or, you know, there can be a lot of reasons. But I don't think, I think that's something to consider. And I don't think I have heard anyone talk about that is, you know, how do we distinguish between the people who are genuinely at threat because from the Taliban and people who are perhaps looking for, there's been a number of people that have been talking. I've heard that there's a general thing going around in Kabul that if you just get to the airport, you'll get on a plane and you'll get a free ticket to a Western country. And then that's, so I think it's important to distinguish between the people who are genuinely facing a threat of death from the Taliban because of their, say, for example, women's rights activists or, you know, something like that, and those who might be a little bit opportunist. And I think it's also important to wait and see what the Taliban actually does. I mean, at the moment, they're promising that they're not going to hurt anybody.
There's no way of telling, right? It's this really scary waiting game actually at the moment, isn't it? And I know, you know, like as you've been saying, you know, there've been calls to prioritize and expedite the evacuation of women's rights activists, particularly, you know, journalists, lawmakers, so many other public figures, as well as some members of Congress, because, you know, they've been very vocal about, you know, the Taliban. And of course, they must be, you know, terrified, right? You know, and I think for young girls as well, you know, especially those who are maybe born after the conflict or after the U.S., I mean, the forces had taken over, Taliban had sort of left. They have no clue, right? They've lived in a completely different world for these last 20 years.
Yeah, and it's got to be, I mean, I think one thing that is still important to point out, though, that, I mean, Afghanistan has long been considered one of the most dangerous countries in the world for women. This is after the Taliban ended their, you know, the last Taliban rule ended. There's been extraordinary levels of violence and discrimination against women in Afghanistan. It may be better in Kabul, but it's still been a very, very dangerous place for women. So I think that there's going to still be a lot of women who are familiar with the ideas and the values and the violence that has come, you know, that the Taliban perpetuate.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think obviously, yeah, it's horrendous. But there's a very real sort of question of how is it going to be possible to evacuate the entire country and where are they all going to go? So there has to be a better solution, I think, than just simply removing every single person who doesn't support the Taliban out of there because it's just too many people. And we have to remember all the other crises around the world as well where there are people trying to leave and get out of their countries. So it's a really difficult question, but I'm not entirely sure what the answer is other than I think that I would hope that the Afghan people resist if the Taliban are not what they want for their government and they're able to find ways to resist, which I know is much easier said than done, but I think it's very complicated and it's going to be, but what I do think is important is to sort of look at this issue of Islamic extremism and that's leading to these kind of ideas that are making people so fearful to live under groups such as the Taliban, because this is also an issue with ISIS right now, Al-Qaeda and Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab and all these other groups that are just as brutal. So it's complicated, I think.
We'll have to see how things play out. But, you know, just looking at the work that you're doing, especially through Project Monmai, what message would you like to leave our listeners with? Things that they should think about, you know, things that maybe they should consider. Anything like that?
I think, like I said earlier, we're all looking at this situation with horror and looking at what it's going to be like for women and girls who are going to have to live under the Taliban and who... The women who have previously lived under the Taliban know just what to expect. And we're horrified by the the extremism of it. Yeah. But I think it's also important to remember in our own societies, we have problems as well. And I say in our own societies because I would make the argument that there is not a single part of the world where there isn't some form of violence and discrimination against women and girls. Everywhere around the world, we try to control the way women are dressed and we justify punishment against them, which is usually in the form of sexual harassment or rape or something like that. Everywhere around the world, women are limited in some way or form, whether it's from going to school, whether it's from going to university or reaching higher levels in their careers. There's so many forms of injustices that take place globally against women and girls. So I think as we look at the Taliban and we look at what that's going to mean for women and girls, I think it's absolutely essential we look at that with criticism. But I think we should also look at ourselves and our societies and question what are we not doing for our own women in our societies to improve their lives and their opportunities so that they can live, women everywhere can live their lives in a way that they want to.
I couldn't put it better, in the way that they want to, right? Not the way somebody tells them they should.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because we're both women, right? And I know I want to be able to make the choices in my life. I want to decide where I live. I want to decide who I marry. I want to decide who I love. I want to decide what I wear and what I do with my life. I don't want that being decided for me by either a male member of my family or by people in my society who I've never even seen or met, you know, who make decisions about what I need to do in my life to be a sort of a good woman. I do that in inverted commas. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, I can't, you know, the things that I guess you and I, you know, take for granted, you know, the freedom to study what we wanted, to travel wherever we want, you know, all those things, you know, never even the thought of, you know, not getting an education was something completely alien, right? You're expected to get a good education and make sure you do well. It's so different, right? The things we take for granted.
Yeah.
As well.
It's against the law in Australia to not send your daughter to school. I mean, you know, it's illegal.
Yeah.
But it's also something I appreciate. I do now appreciate. My dad was always very, very adamant about education and especially about higher education.
Yeah.
And he really pushed me and my sister to get one. And now that at the time I felt it was annoying, you know, you should stay out of my life. But, you know, now I really do appreciate that because I realize how rare that is actually around the world, where a father would actually not only want his daughter to be highly educated, but actually push her to be highly educated. And so I think that, you know, yeah, I'm not grateful for the rights that I've had because I deserve those rights, as does every single woman and girl around the world.
Yeah, right. Yep.
I just want every other woman and girl around the world to have the same opportunities as I've been able to have because of my country and my culture.
Yeah. And I think, you know, all of us who have experienced that should be pushing for that, you know, as well. We should, you know, use whatever power we have, whatever voice we have to make sure that is something that, you know, one day becomes a reality. I mean, we talk about the sustainable development goals. We talk about, you know, equality, equity. That is something that those of us in the position of, you know, power, I suppose, should really push for.
Absolutely. And I think it's so important for us as well is to encourage those ideas that it is okay to be educated. It is okay to have a voice. It is okay to have an opinion. It is okay to want to make your own choices. Because I think, at least what I've discovered in so many parts of the world, including here in Cambodia, where I am now, those kind of ideas are not even prevalent in the social spaces in which girls are growing up. So they don't, I think they grow up, so many girls grow up around the world, and also in Western countries too, where it's like not even in their minds that it's possible to sort of rise to become prime minister or to say, I'm going to be a lawyer and I'm going to be bossy and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to be aggressive in my career with what I want to achieve. It doesn't even occur to them that those are things that could happen. So I think it's also important for women who know that those things can happen to share those ideas that they can happen, if that makes sense.
Oh, totally. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, when you come from a place of privilege, you know, you make sure you try your best to make sure everyone else has that same. And unfortunately, it is a privilege in some places, right? Even though it should be a right. Yeah, we should make sure everybody has those same rights as, you know, everyone else.
I think that would be a fantastic global goal. you know, that it's not seen as a privilege, that it is seen as a fundamental right.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something you're lucky to have. It's just something you're owed as a human being in the world.
Yeah.
And I think that's something I don't know who would not want that.
I think I can name you some who might not want that, but those are the ones we need to fight.
Right. But I think in my experience, I've been to so many places talking to so many women and girls, and that's very, very rare that I've ever met a woman that doesn't, or a girl like those schoolgirls I met in Afghanistan, that don't want more for their lives. They just can't.
Mm.
You know, they're too restricted by the social and cultural norms of their place.
Yeah.
And it's too hard for them to fight. I remember interviewing a woman in the Maldives, and she was talking about it's becoming a lot more conservative in the Maldives. There's a lot of influence coming in from Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, and every woman I spoke to complained about a changing culture. They said women are wearing more black, and there's more restrictions being put on us, and they gave a lot of examples. And, you know, they didn't like it. This was something that they didn't like, and they didn't want to be happening in their society. But I remember this one woman, I said to her, you've got to stand up against it. And she's like, oh, but they are very strong. Talking about the Islamists that were imposing these ideas. And this is, I think, the challenge everywhere. It does feel very difficult to do. But I think that the more discussion that happens on these topics, and that the more spaces that the media gives to women to talk about these kinds of things, then we have a really good chance of making the world a more fair and just an equal place for women and girls.
Yeah, definitely. Keeping that conversation going is, one way of doing it. And, you know, I'm just curious to know, for Project Monma especially, you know, what are some of your plans, moving forward? I'm sure COVID has also impacted the work that you do. You know, what's happening? You know, what's in the pipeline?
So, yeah, it has definitely, because I usually am planning different projects in different places, and I just haven't been able to move from Cambodia for the last little while.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been working on doing lots of writing, and actually the next thing that I really want to focus on is kind of a bigger project than I usually do, which is on human trafficking in Southeast Asia. So I've started doing research for that, and I've had, but it's difficult at the moment because of all these restrictions on movement, with lockdowns and everything like that. But that's the next project, and I'm focusing on writing up a lot of the data that I had from Afghanistan and Tajikistan, especially Afghanistan at the moment, because it's such a hot topic, if you like.
Okay. All right. Well, I hope we keep in touch, and, you know, I hope to hear from you, you know, hopefully when things get a bit better, and to find out more about those projects. But thank you so much for speaking with me today, Joanna.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking to Dr. Joanna Higgs. She's a women's rights activist. She's an anthropologist. She's also the founder of Project Monma. If you'd like to find out more about the work that she does, you can just head to their website, which is just projectmonma.co. That's project, MONMA.co. Find out more about the work that she does. Lovely stories there, you know, about all the different places that you've been to, all your different experiences. You know, really, there's a wealth of knowledge there. Do check it out. And if you miss any part of today's interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can search for the podcast at bfm.my/learn, or you can find it on the BFM app. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.